The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Ms. Ratliff is going to give us a review of the safety seminar. And then I want to carry on a discussion about safety. And then I want to start introducing more about the narrative approach at the end of class. And I'm going to talk about, I'm going to give a short narrative of a film that I saw this past weekend. All right?
Inadequate, but they just went ahead anyway. The testing and just approved it. So what they think happened is the joints in the engine way gave way, the engine flooded, there was spray on the switchboard, and a lot of electrical problems occurred, which resulted in a loss of propulsion. They were unable to blow the ballast tanks, and the submarine was lost. So one of the conclusions they came to are that there were many deficiencies. There were deficiencies in, like, the shipbuilding and the maintenance. There were not enough records. No one really knew what had been done to the sub. No one knew what tests had been done. Just the records were really poor. And there were also problems with the operational procedures. So SubSafe was created, and his goal, I thought of our code of ethics discussion, the goal of SubSafe is to provide, and I quote, maximum reasonable assurance of two things, hull integrity and operability and integrity of critical systems. So that is the goal, and it's very, you know, it's almost very rigid, which kind of goes back to what we're talking about in the hall, but that is the purpose of SubSafe. They don't worry about weapons, they don't worry about the training of the crew. All they're concerned about is keeping the hull intact and the critical operational things on the sub intact, and that's what their goal. He started out, his first slide was actually the quote from George Santayana, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." And one of the first things he talked about was a big part of safety is boring. It's doing the same thing over and over. It's checking twice. A lot of it's really dry. And that's their culture there. And he talked about the difference between, like, NASA culture and what they had at SubSafe. He was saying how they have this NASA benchmark exchange, and one of the differences the people from NASA say is, you guys at SubSafe emphasize your failures. We don't feel the need to do that. He was saying that's a really, really important part of safety at SubSafe, looking back at past failures, going over it again and again and again, double-checking, and it was just really something that's embedded in the culture. So another thing that he talks about is, we have this goal in mind just to provide this assurance of the hull integrity and the critical systems. He drew what he called the SubSafe certification boundary. And so, again, along those same lines, it was interesting. I think there are probably some analogies to ethics that we can make, but he definitely drew a clear boundary around this area that he is only concerned about, and everything else, it's not his problem. I thought that was interesting. He also talked a little bit about the organizational relationships, how their program managers, who are only concerned with cost and schedule, and how there's an independent technical authority that is not really part of the managerial process. Like, they have to okay, and they're completely separate. I'll draw the diagram if you guys want to see. But just in terms of the way the organization is structured, that's something that is unique. Especially something like NASA, the technical authority really does have a certain amount of independence to say no, go and set the standards independent of what the managers say. Everything that they do, this is another interesting point I want to bring up, is based on objective quality evidence. I think OQE is how, I don't know if they refer to them that way, but that was the abbreviation he used. And all of their observations can be tested and have to be verified. And so this has direct, I thought, linkage to what we were talking about when we were talking about knowledge and how you get to truth. But for them, it has to be able to be tested. It has to be able to be verified. He made the point that honest mistakes will kill you just as fast as any other mistakes. It it doesn't matter if you think you did it. You can be a great person, but unless your work can, if I can double check and test it and verify, he's not going to go with it, which I thought was a really interesting point. Another interesting point I want to bring up, I'm really summarizing because this lecture was 2.5 hours.
And I'm trying to get
ahead. Yeah, I forgot to mention that part to you, Krista. So I'm not going to go through all the nitty gritty details. I'm just picking out the parts that I thought were interesting. He said something at the end that organizations such as SelfSafe have to guard against three things: ignorance, arrogance, and complacency. And we saw a few videos, one from the Challenger, one, I don't know where that oil rig was. Do you know what the project was? That actually, I guess, tipped over and sunk into the Atlantic, right. I think is what it was. But according to Mr. Ford, those were the three things that we need to
Ignorance, arrogance, and complacency.
And I guess people ask questions as to how SelfSafe is able to like navigate around those three things and how it is that they haven't become complacent after. I mean, I think it's been, well, since 1963, since the program was instituted, they never lost a SelfSafe certified submarine ever. And so somehow they've managed not to become arrogant and say, well, I don't know what the arrogant part, what do you think about
it? Keep going. You're doing fine.
So, and it was just interesting. And for him, I think the key really was just to reemphasize his past failures, to go over again and again and again until you don't get complacent and to really understand why SelfSafe was formed and what it was about. Dr. Levinson, I think, made a point about accountability and responsibility that might have to do with the military, which is another reason why this program might be so successful. She talks about, was it the Challenger disaster that she brought up that no one really was demoted? Like, there was one person who got a lateral move, but everybody actually pretty much involved was promoted at a certain point.
I think that was, excuse me, was I think that was the Columbia.
Was it Columbia? Okay.
Because Widnall had a whole lot to say about that.
Yeah.
Sheila Widnall was there.
Was there. And that was another interesting point that, you know, in the military and within SelfSafe and in the Navy, there's a direct link between your accountability and responsibility. You're held responsible for everything. If you do something wrong, there's no way that you're going to be promoted. They're not going to overlook it. And that might be one of the reasons that they're so successful. Professor Broom, that's all I was going to talk about. I have a couple more pages of notes. Again, I could go on and on for a couple more hours.
Well, let me see if I can't keep this thing going. Not for 2.5 hours. That was 2.5 hours. That was 2.5 hours. He entertained all questions, but there was not a Q&A period.
I see. So who would stop as people had questions?
Right. He just continued on and I'm not suggesting he was terse with any of the questions, but the lecture was not, in other words, the 2.5 hours was primarily his presentation. Okay. And tell you what, let me make some observations, but I still want Ms. Ratliff to be in charge of the discussion. Okay, one observation is that welding. When I knew welding 30 years ago and welding today is still primarily an art. In as much as you, all four of us can take the same welding course, all four of us can get the same grade, but one of us is going to be a better welder than the rest of us. And the only way you can know if the weld, if my weld or if your weld is better than ours, is to check it afterwards, which is expensive. Either tear it down and look at it, or they have these x-ray and other kinds of, some, I think it's x-ray, but other kinds of methods, sophisticated methods of telling whether or not a weld is good. So the only way they can, they, that makes sense to check weld is welding is, number one, is to make sure the people who do the welding are certified to do it, highly certified. And the second thing is to make some spot checks. And so far as I am concerned, the most important thing about spot checking is not the percentage of spots that you take, it's the percentage of your welds, the percentage of your welds, the percentage of my welds. It varies with the individual, and it varies with the weather and other things. Welding is still an art form. Concrete pouring is still an art form. depends on the weather and other things. A lot of other anomalies that you can't control. And there's usually one person on a big job that goes over and tests. There are these people who go and get these samples of concrete and they test them after the fact. But there's usually some old person who's been on hundreds of jobs that goes around and checks as the concrete is going in. So this issue of the welding of the joints, okay, is not simply a matter of a technical matter. It's a personal skill level, art form. And a few people, I think.
How did that come into the job?
Because the thresher failed at welding joints.
Okay, I didn't hear that.
And they had to set up standards for welding. And the main standards were, too, as I think Ms. Ratliff said, it's the certification of the welder and the spot checks. You didn't use the word spot, I think, but you used something about this. You check a certain amount of the welds.
Okay. I was imagining bolts or something, kind of welding joints.
Joints.
Yeah. And there is something, I don't know if I mentioned that, but you're right. The welders and people who work on this stuff have to go through the certification process also. So not any welder off the street can get on.
I think he said only like two civilian yards
that they could be taken to. The materials have to be certified.
Mm-hmm. And welding is dangerous. The most dangerous part of welding is not the obvious part. The most dangerous part of welding is handling heat and starting a fire or burning the operator. When I was an engineer, one of the first things they do with a construction engineer is put them in charge of welding. Now, you don't know anything about welding, right? But you're in charge of welding. You're the engineer in charge. One thing that you have to do is make sure the welder wears his mask, because sometimes it'll be hot. They get arrogant, think they can know everything. They take it off, and it'll burn the inside of their eyes from inside. And I don't understand how that happens. It's got something to do with something that's coming off of that weld other than heat and light. There's some other rays or something that's coming out. So it's dangerous. It's also dangerous in closed environments because you don't know what the oxygen levels are. The oxygen levels can be too high. Or there can be some other chemicals in the air that could be dangerous. So that's interesting.
And that is the root cause. And they talk a little about that when you investigate an accident, such as what happened with the USS Thresher. The Navy must get to the root cause, whereas NASA does not necessarily. For example, everyone knows about the foam hitting the tiles on the wing. They still have not gotten to the root cause. And Dr. Levins are saying it would be interesting to see if they will in fact launch in July because they're supposed to and they still haven't gotten to the root cause. And that was a really important point to the joints and, you know, they really are fairly sure that that is the root cause and got to it. And it happened fairly quickly too. I mean, I thought it was interesting. One of the immediate responses from the USS Thresher being launched was all Navy submarines, this is during the Cold War, were prohibited to go below a certain depth. And they did that without thinking about it because, you know, they really place such an importance on getting to this root cause and understanding until they do, nobody was allowed to go below this level. They set up a court of inquiry. They had to testify in front of Congress. And this was all, I think, just a couple of months after the disaster. So very quickly they moved, you know, to figure out what went wrong.
There's another point that I'd like for you to mention. The one where this nuclear sub ran into this mountain.
Oh, yes. And I guess January. I don't know. I think it was January of last year, 2005. There was a sub that was, I think, off the coast of Guam somewhere, mm-hmm. and ran into an uncharted mountain. And apparently, it was going at a pretty good speed and just hit head on. And the sub, the hull, remained intact. There was one person who died, I think, later from injuries that were sustained.
Well, the front of it looked like an accordion.
Yeah, did it really?
It was an uncharted mountain. They ran into it. I don't know how fast they were running, but
they had to be
30, 40, 50 knots maybe. That's about 20.
Sending beams out into the
water.
Sonar?
You're standing there. I mean, suppose you're standing there with a hot cup of coffee, talking to somebody.
Yeah.
That's true.
The thing is running at 40 miles an hour, let's say. I don't know, 30 miles an hour. And all of a sudden, it hits him. What does that mean? It stops.
Yeah, no, I can't believe there weren't more deaths or survived.
Right,
but I can't believe it didn't, attack the mountain.
Yeah, I would think they would.
Yeah, well, you think that the satellites would have had all of that worked out. All of the. I've got a map on my wall at my office. So big. And it has. Of course, it's two-dimensional, but it's a three-dimensional relief mm-hmm. of the whole Earth spread out on a plane, and you can see the mountains and all of that. And so it was done by satellite. Well, each mountain range is long, but each mountain looks like a little inverted V. And you can see, I was thinking back when he said that, I could see how they might miss one.
Yeah.
So it survived,
and,
though.
And they really saw it, as a success because, the sub was not only, the hull was intact, but it was able to make it back to land on its own power. No one had to come get it. And again, the whole front, the port was smashed in. Significant damage, but it was okay. So they
saw
it was a success story.
Now that was in 73? 19 what? Thresher?
Thresher was in 63.
Thresher was 63.
April 63.
Okay. Alright, so let's see. Thresher. I remember the Thresher. The Thresher sort of terrified people because it was the first time that there was a nuclear accident with a sub. There was a nuclear accident with a military. In the military that we knew about, I mean, that people generally knew about. It was clouded in a lot of uncertainty. There were a lot of things that were kept secret about that sub. There were a lot of things that the newspapers said were kept secret that might not have been kept secret that just nobody knew about. Okay, so it was this cloud of distrust about that thing. When I asked Mr. Ford about his opinion that on the one hand, the mission for SubSafe was a military mission, but the affected parties are potentially not just the environment, which he said was true, but also the general public. I mean, it's not just a case where there's a military accident that goes wrong and military people get hurt. It could be anybody. And my understanding of his answer was that containment of the accident inside of the submarine was one of their missions, and that if
that no matter how bad it gets, if it doesn't get out into the environment, then it can't hurt other people. Right? So he did answer that question. Now that has moral, moral dimension, because you talk about the range of affected parties. It also has this big possible question about affected parties that, on the one hand, we can say that as citizens we take some responsibility for the threshold. Okay. But if it's outside the 12-mile limit, then there are a lot of people who are not citizens, fishermen, a lot of people, not to mention the environment, who were not parties to the decision, but are affected parties, or parties affected by what we do. And that becomes your international issue now. In 1972, okay, I finished my doctorate, and my dissertation was, guess what, on submarines. It was funded by the Navy, and my dissertation was on what you call a prolate spheroid. So you've got an ellipse that you rotate in its minor axis, and you get this football shape. And one of the issues was hull failure. And we were looking at hull failure under pressure that, because you're talking about a thin shell, and the term of art for my area of study was called shell theory. And the issue was buckling of this hull. And before the hull would reach a pressure that would crack it or bend it totally out of shape, there was a failure mode that was much lower than that pressure, in which part of the shell would buckle and was called snap through buckling. Another term of art. And if you know what I mean when I say oil can, that you've got a can usually has a long spout like this, and you put that spout down in a machine where you want the oil to come out, and to get the oil come out, this part back here is not flat, it's slightly arced, and you press it. And then it clicks. You get click through. Well, you get the same thing with an empty beer can. Okay. You press it, and after a while, you get it, feel that click. If you let it go, it'll click back. Okay, that's called snap through buckling. And we were looking at means of finding the critical load for that snap through buckling, and we found that the buckling would actually occur in little elliptical sections around the middle of the shell. So we were interested in deep submersibles, and the thresher was still alive in our conversations in 1972. So some of these issues bring back old memories that he was talking about. And let's see. Could you read again, please, Ms. Ratliff, this mission, maximum reasonable assurance, blank, blank, blank. So hull integrity has to do with containing any accident, nuclear accident, within the hull, all right, as well as other things. So far as ethics is concerned, that containment means that the affected parties are only the soldiers. One of the motivations for the research we were doing was that they were talking at the time about making a hull one solid section, no welding. Secondly, when it comes to military personnel on a nuclear sub, right, the only way you can get there, no matter what your rank, is first of all to volunteer. You cannot be drafted. The second thing is that all of the officers in the United States nuclear submarine service until Admiral Rickover's death were personally interviewed by Admiral Rickover. Personally. So you can say what you want, but in the end, I think that says something about selectivity. All right. Because I was, he had a reputation for. Well, his reputation is best described by words that I would not use in this class. Okay. But words that, if he were alive, he would not object to. So it was very selective. So the point is that a moral issue is that all of the people serving on a nuclear sub, volunteers. And are people who are well equipped with the technology.
I think another interesting ethical issue is, you know, I just thought of like respect for persons and what it required of you. Professor Woodnoff made the point that astronauts are, you know, are people who have this mentality of let's go where adventures. And you're saying these are not risk averse people.
Right.
You know,
Because what this does is it you all probably know this movie by some of its repeats and some of its Alien 2, Alien 3. How many do they have? Six or seven of them?
I've never seen it.
You never seen any of them?
Nope.
Oh, count yourself lucky. Alien, I'll never forget. The first time I saw Alien was in a movie theater in New York City. One of the things that I'll never forget about Alien was that I was standing in line to go in as the people were coming out. I'll never forget the looks on those people's faces when they came out of that movie. I wasn't too sure if I wanted to go in there. But the thing about Alien that makes a big moral issue for a class in engineering ethics is that it was the first, I think it's fair to say, the first popular science fiction movie made where the expedition was not done under the auspices of somebody's government. It was a private corporation. All right. So that changes everything, because how much have the rest of us participated in their ethical you know, and their safety standards and all. Well, we can say they have to pass government standards, but 100 million miles out, you know, bringing stuff back that nobody ever has seen before, what are they going to do? They're going to, well, the point I'm trying to make is that this movie Alien, I think, is a real contrast in our ethical stances with what we see here in the Navy. Star Trek, if you remember, that was military. You know, all of these others were somehow government / public sponsored trips, if not military trips, or expeditions. Even by the aliens. Right? Even by the aliens. Alien came out and it was business. Okay. If you ever see this movie called, or the first one called Predator. Saw Predator? How many of them?
Just one.
Which one? The first one?
The first one.
I haven't seen it enough times yet, Predator. But Predator introduces another dimension that follows up from Alien. And that is, this was a private expedition. People are out on a hunting trip from another planet. But it's not government. It's not business. They're out on a hunting trip. And so who controls their potentials for unleashing lethalities upon the rest of us just by merely exploring space? Who knows what you're going to bring back?
Well, now we have those questions in America because there are private space venture companies. There are several entrepreneurs who are...
What are they? Just a space trip?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, now it's suborbital.
So okay. How soon are we?
Their safety standards are a question that we don't have to.
Have they started, have they had any tours yet? Or they...
I should know this. Has anyone gone suborbital? I don't think anything has gone up yet.
But it's microgravity, though. Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
All right. There was a company I know about, and was, I only know, let's put it this way, I know about it from, I guess, I wouldn't call it gossip, but it was common knowledge, let's put it that way, among NASA employees where this company presumably had gotten licensed to bury you in space. And if you wanted to be cremated, they'd put your ashes in orbit. They claim. I don't know if they're doing it, but yeah. I'll call it common knowledge. Okay. I call it common knowledge because everybody said so. I mean, you get up to a presentation given by the NASA assistant director, they'd mention it, you know, that kind of stuff. But I never saw actually the proof. Let's go back a second to what Widnall said and what Levinson said, and that is, especially with these natural astronauts, I don't know if what they said applied to McAuliffe. Okay. I believe, without question, what they said about all of the rest of the astronauts, that if it was left to them, there would be no safety standards for themselves. And I can see the point to that. If I was an astronaut, I would feel pretty much, I would be what the Marines call gung-ho. I'd want to go. You know, stop me from going with all of these rules. Okay. But McAuliffe brings in a whole new factor, because she was not a military, it was and she was picked out of a pool of people, of ordinary people.
She did choose to go.
She chose to go, but she was still not trained to die for this stuff. Right. She might have been willing.
She wasn't part of the culture.
No. And the whole point of NASA taking her on board was to sell NASA to the rest of us. So it would have been counterproductive to get somebody who was as gung-ho as the rest of them, because the rest of us are not that gung-ho. Okay, let's see. We're not going to go on for 2.5 hours.
No. Just one thing I thought was interesting, now that the world is flat and everything is global, he did make a point about differences, and how when he went to Asia, there's this whole attitude of don't challenge. And part of what he does is he double checks on what you do. Okay, you said you did that. Well, you know I'm going to be right behind you checking to make sure that we can test this, we can verify it. And in Asia, it's a different culture. People, you know, kind of respect. They say, oh, did you do that? Okay. And they kind of take your word, and it's kind of considered disrespectful to go back and double check and say, are you sure you did it? And again, he just made the point. It could be an honest mistake, but it can still be a mistake. So I thought that was an interesting statement, that maybe these cultural differences make it different.
You have cultural differences. One thing is for sure that I've experienced myself, and that is I've been other cultures where people would defer to my age. You don't get that around. Well, no, they do. It was about a year ago I noticed that young ladies would hold the door for me when I walk into a building. but now there was a big change in America. I remember going to a lecture, going to a conference. I went to this conference, and I went to two conferences. Where I was pretty much the only male in there. One of them was called...
Must not have been an engineering conference.
Actually, it was. Yeah. I'll tell you about this one. It was called Breaking the Glass Ceiling.
Oh.
And all of the speakers, save one, maybe two, but definitely, were women who had made it in engineering.
Okay.
And all of the rest of them were not so much women who were trying to make it, but women who wanted to write about making it. And it was sponsored by people. It was sponsored by what they call the National Engineering Foundation. And the proposal was written by women, many of them who were involved in engineering ethics and this kind of thing. Engineering Public Policy, STS people. As a matter of fact, they had this conference up in Canada at a ski lodge, but it was in the summertime. And so I went in to register, and they had plenty of money. They were putting everybody up in condos. And it was only two people to a condo. You're talking about two floors of condo. Okay? Really nice places. Let's put it this way. Much better than the Hyatt, all right? All right. And they put me in this condo. And they said, you'll have one housemate. I said, fine. I said, oh, by the way, do you know who my housemate is? They said, well, look it up. And they looked it up and they said, oh, yes. I don't know what her name was, Sheila McGee or something. I said, wait a minute. But I can't go in there with this lady. And the people who were at the registration desk stood up, put their hands on the hips, and said, how did you get to be so special? So they went on up there. So I stayed on the phone with my wife. Well, anyway. But at that conference, what would I bring that up for? The speaker got up, the main speaker got up and made a comment that the last session, the last
presentation she had made was at a university, and she had to go through these revolving doors, and she said only three students tried to run her down in the in the turnstile, you know. Well, the revolving door. Mm-hmm. People laughed, but they weren't. But in other cultures, there is still a respect for age. And in some other cultures, there is a respect for, let me put it this way. There's a respect for position of authority, but not because you have power, because you have the responsibility. And people respect that, and they don't like to overrule it. And I think that's what he discovered. Where was that? In Guam. It was in Southeast Asia. And he was saying that people in different levels of authority would not challenge a person at a higher level of authority, but he gave the impression to me that corresponded with my experience, that it wasn't fear so much. It wasn't power, an issue of power differential. It was respect that if you have all of this responsibility, then I should respect you for that responsibility. So whereas his job was really not to respect anybody, to go in there. His job was to go in there and check everything behind everybody and find people at fault. So it was difficult. Okay. I just want to make two other comments. He used the word arrogance. Okay. My experience in these matters is that arrogance is, first of all, a very good word, but I think it's best understood as pride. Too much pride being associated with the organization and the people that you're with. And it turns out to be arrogance also, but there's a collective arrogance. It's not an individual arrogance. Proof. If you attack their organization, they get offended. Any questions about what military people call, since I was in the military, any questions about what people call lines of authority, accountability, and responsibility?
I think if I understand that, can you go through maybe briefly?
I'll give you one example that doesn't have anything to do. Well, it's not the military, but what I brought. When I was a department chair, I had an assistant department chair. When I was away on travel, my assistant department chair, there was a faculty member that had a heart attack or something, couldn't show up for class. I was away for a week. Students were going to class and there was nobody there. My assistant chair called up a person that he knew and hired the person to teach the class. When I got back, I knew this individual, and my attitude was that I had an experience with him that was potentially illegal if we had done it together. I told him I wouldn't do it, and I didn't want this kind of person standing in front of the students with power. So I fired him. And he sued for defamation of character. And the university decided that it was in the university's interest to just settle. So, and they took it out of my budget. So then the provost, wasn't called provost at Howard at the time, but same thing, provost, vice president of academic affairs, called me in and said, how can we deal with this issue in the future? And I said, well, in the military, we have something called authority, accountability, and responsibility. And I said, what we should do is precisely what you all have done, but you need to make a policy. And that is that as department chair, I was responsible for what happened. That means I am subject to punishment for what happens. But my department assistant chair was only accountable. That means he had to produce all of the evidence. But he did not. But if he had done the wrong thing, even, he does not go to jail. I'm the one that goes to jail.
You're responsible.
Because I'm
responsible.
Responsible means subject to punishment for the action. Accountable means
ability to explain it with facts. Okay. Explain the situation and to be able to support your explanation. So if you give somebody responsibility, then you also have to give them the power to exercise their responsibility, and that's authority. So the person with responsibility has authority. The person with responsibility can delegate authority to another person, but cannot delegate responsibility.
And in the Navy, accountability directly corresponds to responsibility. So if you're accountable for something you're responsible for, I think it was...
No, you can have a subordinate officer or person be accountable. Many times those are, in the Army, they're sergeants. The sergeant knows more about what's going on in the unit than the captain does. So the sergeant is supposed to produce all of the facts.
Okay, so for subsafe, that was the point that she was making, that subsafe is unique and that accountability does go right along with responsibility.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
I think that's the point.
That was, and she said it was unique.
Yeah, it was unique.
Right. Okay. Right. That a person with the authority and responsibility has accountability also. That's, I doubt if that will work a whole lot of the places. Because
yeah.
It's just too big. So when I was a company commander, I had another officer who was a deputy company commander, but I had a bunch of sergeants. And so I had to ask a question about stuff. I brought in these sergeants, told them to lay down the facts. Then once they laid them down, I excused them. The officers would talk about it. There's a big moral issue about in Vietnam called, I think I covered it, Me Lie. And I compared it to the Nuremberg principle. Okay, and the starting point of the issue for the military was that this was an officer, and that the officer was responsible, even though his men did the shooting. The men were not responsible,
yeah.
But they were accountable. They had to come back and say what they did.
Yeah.
And there's a term of art that I still understand. Stand is the case in the Army. Checked with some friends, but my last account was that even if your soldiers are half female, they're still called the men.
Mm-hmm.
And even if the commander is a female, you say, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. They still haven't gotten it. Yeah. Okay, I think... any other issues on this? Well, thank you very much, Ms. Bradley. If you want to have the last word.
I was just going to try to segue over into closing ethics. Are we going back to that
now? Actually, I wanted to tell this story, and there was something else I wanted to do. This movie I saw.
Yeah, okay, so wait a minute. I'll save it for closing ethics.
Well, no, we'll tell, well, since we're...
Well, I just thought that one interesting is what we just saw, so there's such a rigidity. Like, I just really saw that, you know, they definitely have a code and they have the principles that they adhere to so strictly. And so, and it just took me back to what we were talking about with codes of ethics. And I just think to myself, you know, is this good? Morally allows for no kind of, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that we didn't discuss in there, and that was how does all of this
discussion of safety work out in a combat situation?
Right.
When clear the mission is now more important than the ship and crew. All of the cases he discussed were peacetime failures. What happens in wartime?
Right.
Okay.
Because I would think that some of these like rules will kind of just get thrown to the side if they are in a, like, well, if you're in a combat situation, if they're, you know, pressed for time. I'm thinking to myself, how could they possibly do all these things that he's saying now?
Yeah.
And there's nothing built into the system that would allow you to deviate one way or another from it, so that.
Well, frankly, I think the military makes it very clear, at least to their officers, the mission comes first. Now, excuse me, I'll tell you where there's a issue that is sort of in the gray area. And that's when you're at peace, but in a Cold War. Now, this situation was brought up in another film. A real situation. I'm trying to think of the name of the film, but it had to do with this Russian submarine that went down. Even the Americans went over to try to save it. And the crew died in there. And there was this issue that they really didn't want the Americans to see their technology. And a movie was made out of that, part fact and part fiction. But got over the moral question, I think, very well, and I'm trying to think of the name of it. But I'll tell you who is. Harrison Ford starred in it.
Yeah.
And he starred as a. I'm not talking of. Don't get it mixed up with the one that Sean Connery starred in. But it's the one that Harrison Ford starred in. He played the part of a Russian submarine commander. All right. The one that Connery played in was.
One of them is not for October. Yeah, I wonder. But I don't think that's the one he's talking about. I know the one you're talking about.
Right?
You know,
It was not as popular as the one that Connery played in. Connery, his one was where the Russians had a piece of technology on this nuclear sub that was so effective that it could shift the power, military power, one way or another in the whole world. And his basic idea was that no one country should have that technology. Now, there's another story that I don't know if anybody ever made a movie of, and it doesn't need a movie because all you have to do is just deal with the facts per se. And that is... a man by the name of Niels Bohr, B-O-H-R, Bohr's Atom, same. When the United States was working on the Manhattan Project, Niels Bohr was a part of that. Niels Bohr really irritated a whole lot of people because he thought that the United States nor any one country should have the bomb. And he was making a lot of speeches saying that the technology ought to be made public. And he had already had the Nobel Prize, so it wasn't an easy matter just to shut him up. But that issue, you know, is there something that's so powerfully destructive that no one nation should have custody of it or the knowledge about it, is worthy of discussion in this class? So, and if you want to start either with the fiction through this movie, either of these movies, or start with Niels Bohr. And just deal with the facts. But they all bring up the same issue. So if you do see a movie like that, then you've got a 5-minute presentation, 10-minute Q&A. Time for the class. codes of ethics. Okay. Now, then I'll make a mention that. Then I want to talk about this movie.
Yeah.
Okay. The last thing I think I'm ready to say about, actually, let's count codes of ethics now as a continuing discussion, not as a module that we're going to be through with. From the standpoint of this class, let's see, we got visitors. All right, we still have 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes more. You're going to have to, if you think that the term codes of, that these codes of ethics are actually ethical rules, then my charge to you is to be able to justify that, and to justify that on a rule-by-rule basis, because a lot of these codes are not ethical codes. I think they are best called codes of practice or professional practice, right, or guidelines. One of them is actually called guidelines. They might even be statements of, might be ideals.
Some of them are even like contracts. I mean, it sounds like they're treated like contracts. You're a member of this organization, and this is what you will do.
I think it's
okay not to think of these as ethical rules. That's why the topic was bothering me, because I was trying to think of them.
So I think that the term code of ethics is a misnomer. But it is a term of art, so you have to deal with that fact. It is, you know, any good encyclopedia would have that term in it. But as a scholar, you have to, like I said, if you want to differ with what I said, then you're going to have to find a justification for it. But you just cannot take it at face value. That's my main point. You just cannot take that term as being revealing at face value. I think also from, I think they have legal significance. But in a code, in an ethics class, we need to think about them, I think, as ideals and or guidelines for professional practice. Okay. I want to talk about this film. Can I go to that now? I give you the bad news first. Can't remember the name of the film. Well, I tried so hard to it was a Tibetan film in subtitles, English subtitles, and they had the translation for the film. And I tried very hard to pronounce that word. Kekeleksi is the best I can do with it right now. But I think the film was called Mountain Patrol. It's in the newspapers. It's part true. It's taken from a true story that occurred in the early 90s. Maybe 93 to 95, 90, something like that. Where in Tibet there is this antelope called the Tibetan antelope. And the pelt from the antelope is very valuable. And there were these Tibetans who were poaching these antelopes down to almost extinction. And there were these Tibetan police who were after the poachers. And And the Tibetan police, though they were authorized to go after the poachers, were not paid by the government. They were authorized, but they were not paid. And the poachers were, you know, like poachers are today in Africa. They will kill a policeman. So it's not just a matter of stealing it. You go to war with these people. So they had killed a whole bunch of policemen. And the policemen had killed some of them. You know, a lot of them. But the policemen who were out on this mission were completely, like the astronauts, completely dedicated to preserving these antelopes. Now, I'll get to this one scene that sets up the moral issue. The film gets its energy, better stated, the point of view of the film is provided by a young man who works for a newspaper who goes up to the mountains to cover the story from the point of view of the police. Y'all might remember my... Did I tell you a story about Leon Dash, my buddy? Maybe I thought this was another class.
I think you might have.
When he went to Angola. I'll tell it at the end of class if I have to. But anyway, he goes up there to go with them. He knows the language because his father was Tibetan. So that gets over the language issue, but the rest of us in the film don't know, so it's subtitled. And he's riding around with them and learning all of the problems. Well, there's this one scene where he's sitting there in this truck interviewing the captain of the police. And he learns from the captain that they had not been paid for a year. And so he says, well, how do you keep going? You got to pay these men. You got to feed them. Where do you get? You got to have your weapons. You got to have bullets. You got to have gasoline for the trucks. How do you keep going? When they were able to catch any poachers and get the pelts, they would take some of the pelts and sell them back into the black market. Look at that contradiction.
Yeah.
You're there to stop the black market, but the only way you can end it, you think, is to participate in it at some level. They give the rest of it back to the authorities, the rest of the pelts. They only keep just enough to keep going. So the, I said, my God, I'm sitting there, you know, how do you going to rationalize? Not rationalize, well, what do you do about a situation like that? Okay? Because automatically I could think of a lot of adaptations of that problem to a lot of other problems in my own life, you know. Politics today, in the class, as a subject for the class, and the conversation continued. Now, before I tell you the last part of the conversation, it's almost like cheating, but let's do it anyway. I'll open the floor for anybody who might want to make a comment or ask a question. Okay, the last. Yeah, the only way to stop it is to participate in it, right? Yeah, I mean, when you say the only way, it's the only way you can think of, all right?
Anybody else? Just goes back to what we're saying, because you can't really have that principle. You can't go in there with the principle that the black market is bad, no matter what you do, it's horrible, and that be like your principle, because then you got to throw that away.
Well, I haven't thought the matter through, but my inclinations are the same as yours, and that is that you probably could not justify this thing in terms of based on a principle. You might be able to justify it in terms of consequences.
Right.
at the greater consequence.
Right. Especially because, yeah, the animals have already been poached.
Yeah, you can say that. Okay, now I'll bring in the last, what I think is a very important part of the last of this whole thing, and that is that the young newspaper man, and it's important to say the young newspaper man because the way that the thing was set up was that the young man met the captain's daughter, and you can tell he's sort of like falling in love, you know. So the young man says, well, you know, if I write this article, you will go to jail for poaching. I mean, you're participating in the black market. And he says, I don't see how I can write this article. And the captain says, you have to write this article. And if I have to go to jail, so be it. Hear it.
Did the captain want him to write the article so that it would be made public that they weren't being paid, or in order to?
Well, we can speculate.
Okay.
Now, I have the advantage because they gave me the character of this man, so I can extend out his character. But when it comes to the facts and all of this, all the logic of it, we're equals. But if I extend out this man's character, I think what he was saying to the young man is, you have to do what you have to do in this life, and I have to do what I have to do. Doesn't mean that they're congruent, so be it. That's what I think he was saying, and I think the movie laid out, at least for me, a sort of fatherly relationship. You know, that's what you do with your son and your daughter. You have to do what you have to do, and I have to do what I have to do. So that's the way that, if it was laid out differently, if there wasn't an emotional relationship with them through his daughter, then you could say, well, what really happened in real life was that the coverage by this newspaper man of what they did changed the whole situation around. Public opinion got out all over the world, and the government had to not only pay them, but had to establish a larger force and do all of these other things. So you could say that, yeah, the solution to the problem was not so much the black market, but public opinion. But the film set up a little bit of an emotional thing, and the characters made it work. Okay, well, this was significant to me for all sorts of reasons, but you're going to see this thing again. You've seen it once before, you're going to see it again next week. I think I talked about my approach to this narrative ethics, that in an engineering situation, sometimes knowing what the right thing is regarded as really not possible at the time. You got to make a decision right away, potentially lethal. And the Western approach to ethics just will not work because you're talking about doing the right thing one way or the other. And so I came in with, from left field, so to speak, with this idea, let's not worry about doing the right thing. Let's do what we think we have to do, and after it's done, hope that everybody will forgive us. Okay, basically. Well, it seems to me that I have two metaphors for that attitude in USA society, but this one provides another metaphor because it says that when I look into the character of the captain, then what he thought he had to do was something that even if he went to jail for, the Tibetan people would have some kind of
understanding of and appreciation for. And in American society, I say that Martin Luther King went to jail. Nobody ever said he shouldn't have gone to jail. But when he got out of jail, they gave him the Nobel Prize for it. One that reaches more closely into, if you have to deal with young Americans, is that there's a good metaphor in basketball. It's called the good foul. It's a way of breaking the rules, making sure that the referee sees you break the rule. And after you have broken the rule, your opponent will congratulate you for it, give you five, good move. So that's what this is all about when I say that a breakaway from the Western tradition and borrow from some other traditions, you're really doing something that fits in with this captain, it fits in with Martin Luther King, it fits in with the good foul in basketball. And one of the chief features is public knowledge. The captain did not want to hide what he was doing. The good foul can only work if the referee sees you and calls you for the foul. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King's going to jail could only work if he went to jail. If he did what he did and hid it and went out, it wouldn't work. He had to be caught. Okay, so a lot of things that people do that they try to justify as being the morally right thing is not going to fit in the category of what I'm talking about because they're trying to keep it secret. And that's where you divide the line. Do they want everybody to know or do they want to say, no, we're going to do the right thing, but let's not tell anybody. That does not fit in what I'm talking about. So that when we do the narrative ethics next week, I want you all to have an intuitive feel for what I am trying to say that goes beneath what might be let out in our at a class, special class.